Okay.
All right, I think we're on. Okay, so in the midst of that, God really started impressing upon us. We were going to other places in the city, going to church, and just realized that there really wasn't a gospel presence in our community. So we visited 5 different Protestant churches that were in our neighborhood, and all of them not preaching the gospel. So we decided, man, I don't know what we're going to do here. Really feel like before it was really cool to use terms like missional and all this kind of stuff, but we felt like we should be in the neighborhood going to church because that's where we lived, and didn't even know to call it incarnational and missional and all those cool things yet. So, but we basically just said, what does God want us to do? Started meeting people in the community, walking around, met people over a course of a couple of years, eventually kind of trying to figure out what seemed to be the right piece for our community and a cultural carryover where we could plug the gospel into. It turned out to look like a coffee shop kind of third place environment. I'll have you know, I don't drink coffee, don't like coffee. Don't know anything about coffee, okay? So, but that appeared to be what God wanted us to do, all right? I'm addicted to Mountain Dew, that's my drug of choice. But a Mountain Dew bar didn't seem like it was gonna go over well. So, coffee seemed to be the deal, just a place where people could sit, hang out, a Wi-Fi spot. Nothing like that really existed in our area. People would go to surrounding neighborhoods to go to those places, but that was a real disconnect from forming community. So we just kind of felt like that was the thing to do. Started looking around at places in our neighborhood with the guy I was in business with at the time, business partners. We both lived in the neighborhood, so we started looking around at different buildings and stuff, maybe to rent, maybe to buy, whatever. Eventually, one day we were out, we looked at one building that was a hardware store that was closing down, and it was on kind of the outskirts of our neighborhood. And I went and looked at it with a realtor, blah, blah. Driving away, driving up Richmond Street, and right in the center of our neighborhood is a community center. Across the street from the community center was a corner bar. Now, Bridesburg historically has been known for either having either a bar or a church on every corner. Literally, there is one place you can stand in our neighborhood and see 6 bars, visibly, from one place. Pretty interesting. So we look at this, the corner bar, it was closing down, and when I was going by, the realtor was actually outside putting a for sale sign on the building. And I'm like, oh, that's a perfect location. Let's stop and talk to him. After a few minutes talking to him, we find out the realtor's a Christian. I explained to him what we're looking to do. He says, I'd love to sell it to you, but I already have an offer on the table. If you can come up with a down payment in 7 days, then we'll, you know, the people selling the building had given him the authority to kind of make a call, and who it goes to said, I want to sell it to you guys since you can do what, you know, God's called you to do here. So it was a Monday. We had until the following Monday to come up with $11,000. I already know we had just incorporated what at the time we were just calling Real Life Ministries. We did not have a bank account, so we didn't have any money either, okay? So we basically, in the course of a week, saw God take this thing, and I was out of town that week, too. I had a trip I had to go on that I couldn't reschedule. So I basically, we kind of put some emails out there, letters, did some stuff, made some phone calls, and I left, went out of town. That's why I watched the mail. I get a call Sunday afternoon. We were going to have to be at settlement Monday morning at 10 o'clock. Sunday afternoon, got a call. It's all here. Really? Okay. So I guess this is what God wants us to do. So in the midst of that, you know, I have to confess, yeah, I didn't have a whole lot of faith that was going to happen. Okay. Do not enjoy raising money. Okay. You may say, why are you a church planner if you do not like raising funds? I don't know, but we still have to do it. In the midst of that, it just happened. It was a total God thing. Confirmed it for us. We bought the building that Monday when settlement did it. Didn't have the money to make the first mortgage payment, but bought the building and just kind of went from there. It has worked out. We've been in the building 5 years now, a little over 5 years, and it's been a great opportunity for us to use, and we'll talk a little bit later about how we use the facility itself to contact and become close to indigenous people in our community. So we'll talk. I'll talk about that a little bit later. In the midst of that, still didn't plan on planting a church. About a year and a half later, a couple people asked us, you know, we had a Bible study, some people had gotten saved. We'd done some kids programs in the neighborhood, some different things. And people said, you know, you guys should plant a church. I said, I don't know anything about church planting. I grew up in a large church in the suburbs, and my dad was a pastor. And I don't know small church. I don't know city church. I don't know church planting. So that's just not going to work out for us. 3 or 4 people kind of mentioned stuff I did to us over the course of about 6 months. I said, you know, eventually my wife actually said to me, you know, why don't we at least pray about this? I'm like, oh, man. I was kind of trying to avoid that. Hopefully, thought people might stop saying stuff about church planting. So we prayed about it. It became pretty clear to us that God wanted us to do that. So began to transition out of working in business in the city and figuring out what church planting looked like. I had literally no background. Okay, there's a lot of different ways to move into church planting. You have guys like you heard Eric downstairs, you heard Dr. Mason. He has been, fortunately for the kingdom and for the benefit of the rest of us, trained, mentored, taught, had lots of opportunities to be around church planting, and learned a ton. And, you know, even today, I still ask him questions, what's, you know, have you been this, who's been on this, who you're reading on this, that kind of stuff. There's many different ways that God pulls people into this crazy world of church planting, okay? We got pulled in from a total kind of blind side. So I just basically started looking for organizations. Checked out 32 different organizations, denominations, missions groups, all kinds of stuff, trying to find one that fit us pretty regular. Couldn't find one. Came across Acts 29. Didn't know anything about him. Connected with a guy across the hall here, Phil Taylor, who strangely enough was a sweet man of mine in college, and found out he was planting a church in Troy, New York, part of a team planting up there. And I'm like, what? What are you doing? How are you doing it? Who are you connected to? We got connected to Acts 29. We'll fast forward a little bit. We are 2.5 years post-launch at this point. We launched in our coffee shop, met there for a little over a year, and then moved, actually about a little over a year and a half, then moved into one of our local schools. We meet in the gymnasium of a charter school on the edge of our neighborhood. Still maintain the coffee shop. There's a two-story apartment above it. We rent it out to guys that work in our ministry, college students, that kind of stuff that need a place to live and want to be part of what we're doing. So that's kind of where we are now. Talking about raising up indigenous leaders, you know, when it was kind of asked of me to kind of talk about this topic, in a lot of ways, I kind of feel like I'm not sure I should be addressing that topic. Like, we did things very organically at the beginning. They kind of happened naturally. We didn't have a whole set of strategic points laid out of how we were going to engage. And just felt like we were living in the community. Our neighbors, for the first time in my life, I'd never lived in the city before, but my neighbors lived on the other side of my wall, so I was going to have to engage them. Okay? There was literally going to be no way for me to avoid my neighbors because they were just there, right? So we found early on our best connections were things like, I think it's actually Ed Stetzer has some quotes for missionality and some good, easy, practical principles. One is like, walk, don't drive. Okay, so wherever you are, if you walk, you can engage people, see people, meet people, they'll see your face. Walk, don't drive. Shop in your community, shop in wherever your city center is, your local center, whatever that is. So walk, don't drive, shop. Keep your kids as local as possible, whether that means, and these are not blanket rules, but whether that means schooling, sports, whatever that can be. Try to help them be engaged locally and teach them how to be engaging people. So those are just some things we started doing in the beginning. We heard it from Ed Stetzer and a couple other people and thought, hey, that sounds like good ideas. Along the way, it had become increasingly clear to us that we didn't necessarily, because of our context, we weren't going to be able to plant a church in Bridesburg with transplanted leaders. Just wasn't going to work there. It's not to say it can't work. It works all over the place. But in our community, it's a very closed neighborhood. It's a very closed section of the city. As Eric said earlier, the Bishop of Philadelphia, Bill Crispin, when you go to plant a church, everybody says, you got to go talk to Bill. I went and talked to Bill. I remember our first time on Richmond Street, sitting in a little pizza shop. And, I had heard all this stuff about Bill Crispin. I'm like, oh, my word. Like, what's going to happen? Should I eat in front of him or not? No. But we're sitting there talking, and Bill says, over 40 years of ministry, in Philadelphia, engaging in church planting, a lot of different kind of stuff, in many different cultures around the city, he had not seen a successful church plant in what we would know as the River Ward districts. So 5 communities that go up the river north of the city. Okay, we would typically start it with Fishtown, but now you got Northern Liberties, it's just kind of blown up in there. But the Fishtown, Port Richmond, Bridesburg, Mayfair, and Wissanomi kind of go together, and then Taconi. Okay, so these River Ward districts go up the river. Lots of old churches that had mostly gone mainline and were declining or dying. and anything new was pretty much prohibited. So we kind of looked at it and said, well, we could go out and recruit a bunch of people and move them into our community. That was one model we had seen and looked at, and we just kind of thought through our context that that's probably not going to work. So we had to kind of figure out what it meant to raise up indigenous leaders. Bring people to Christ from the community, see them grow from spiritual infancy to spiritual maturity, and let them lead, and let them help show us how to lead. Okay, good principles. That I'm going to show you a couple of resources that I've learned a ton from. One is by Harvey Kahn and Manny Ortiz, a book called Urban Ministry. This, I know this is urban ministry, and you may say, how many people here are in a city or an urban kind of context? Okay, a couple. Oh, we're looking at about a half. Okay. Don't think that you can't read this book because you're not in the city. Okay? Most of the principles in this book are pretty transferable to ministry in general. Okay? So this is a great, I use this kind of almost as a textbook. The resources, the philosophies in here, the principles in here are key. They're so important to doing any kind of ministry that impacts people with spiritual transformation and spiritual growth. So this is one that became very key to us. Along the way, another one by Harvey Kahn is called Planting and Growing Urban Churches. Most of my stuff is kind of urban focused because that's what I'm in. So, but the principles, hopefully, we're going to look at in a minute, are transferable. And then Ray Backe, A Theology as Big as the City. And these are all kind of keys that I've not only read but have gone back to, encourage our leaders to read, and just keep going back to them. So there's tons of resources and stuff in there. So some of the stuff today you're going to get is from Kahn and Ortiz's book, Urban Ministry, some of the layouts in there. A lot of what I learned with the three different kinds of leaders that you can plant a church with, relocated, indigenous, or multi-ethnic leadership, they have some of the best stuff on that. We'll take a look at some of the principles in the middle, focusing primarily on the indigenous kind of connection. Beginning question I have for you. How many people are church planting? Some people I know are just kind of coming checking things out. Okay, how many people are part of church plants? Okay? All right. How many people are either planting or part of church plants in the area you're in or going to, you are indigenous to? You grew up, came from there. Okay, not many. One, two, three. About five. Okay, about five or six. All right. This would be pretty typical of church planting in general. Okay, the relocated leader is the one that is denominations and church planting movements in general kind of key on relocated leaders. And what we're seeing a lot is now we're kind of seeing a pendulum swing where churches that have been planted with relocated leaders are seeing the stability that needs to be had by raising up indigenous leaders, okay, and having them carry the bar, have the long lifetime impact, just because it's so much easier for them to relate culturally and relationally and socioeconomically because they have always been there. We're going to look at some of the stuff in a minute that kind of lends towards that. So that just kind of gives me an idea. Most people in here are not planting indigenously. So why are you here learning about raising up indigenous leaders? That was actually a question. Why are you here? Why do you want to learn about that? Okay.
To work with the pastor and his wife who were planting a church plant in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. So that's going to be an Indian church plant. So we know very little culturally. We just know kind of like the call relationally with them in terms of working with the ministry. And so we're really trying to learn how to work alongside them in a way that is helpful. So like a lot of that kind of like structure background reinforcing.
Cool. Good.
I think whether church planted or not, we should be indigenous missionaries where we live at regardless.
Okay.
And that's why.
Good.
The sustainability of the church plant over the long term, a lot of times you better call from outside to start something where nothing exists, but for it to take root and become organic to the community, it helps to have local.
Okay.
My community really takes a lot of, community pride in keeping a small town feel as it grows. It's a very fast growing community, but they legislate and work very hard to stay indigenous. And it's not necessarily a closed community. People come in, but they try and keep it feeling like how it is. And I, outsiders coming in and then trying to create some type of religious movement, how a church plant might be perceived, I think it'd be really weird. So our ties in our community are huge.
Okay. Anybody else want to share? Why is indigenous leadership important? They had some things mentioned. Why else? Ajay.
I transplanted two things, so I'm one of the relocation. So for me, I feel like I need people who are from here, who know this place much better than I do, and who can own this ministry and teach me what it would look like to do ministry well here. Because in ways, I'll always be perceived maybe as an outsider,
sure,
but they won't.
Anybody else? What we've experienced in our community is I've lived in our little, like, 8-square-block neighborhood for 10 years, a little over 10 years. It has maybe been the last 2 years that I think people in the community have actually kind of viewed me as being from there, to a point where, what's the question you always get asked when you meet people in your community? Where are you from? Right? So what do you say if you're a relocated leader? Where are you from? Well, you know, if you say somewhere else, you got like one strike against you right from the bat, right? But you have to say that because you're from somewhere else. I'm just at a point now where I've actually kind of figured out we've been there long enough that I can legitimately kind of say, where are you from? I've lived about 10 years over on Bridge Street. Okay? And that, for whatever reason, just changes the dynamic of our relationship. Changes the dynamic of our conversation. Okay? Oh, that's interesting. 10 years, that's long enough to somewhat understand something. Okay? So it doesn't mean I'm accepted, and I probably will never be accepted as an indigenous leader in my community. That's something I've had to come to grips with. It's probably something you're going to have to come to grips with at some point. Okay? You will never be indigenous because part of what, if you're relocated, because part of what being indigenous means is that's where you're from. So part of the challenges to not being from a particular place and being a relocated leader is you actually have another worldview filter that is not the one that's just where you are now. Okay? Just think about that for a minute, and we're going to hit on it, some of it. Dr. Ortiz and Khan kind of have some interesting things of why the fact that you may have another worldview filter affects your local ministry as far as being indigenous or being relocated. So take a look at that. We'll start off just by taking a look at some things. We're going to focus on urban. If you're not urban, don't feel like you're left out or anything. We're going to hear from you. I want to do some Q&A at the end, and I want to hear out some of these principles because I do not know suburban ministry. I do want to know and hear from you guys that are suburban how some of this stuff applies. What does this look like? We'll talk a lot about city and urban, but you guys kind of give me some feedback at the end. I want to take some notes from you guys too. And we'll do some group learning about what this looks like outside of urban context as well as inside of urban context. First thing that I'm going to throw up there is just the idea that it's interesting as you look through the New Testament and in regards to the city, this word polis, that is literally the word for city, all through the New Testament, it is used 160 times. And I think a lot of times, who do we think of with church planting in the New Testament when we think of church planting? Paul. Okay? Who do we think of? What characterizes Paul's ministry? His missionary journeys, his church planting efforts, raising up leaders. What characterizes it? What did Paul say when he was going into a place? Expose Christ to someone, give him the gospel, maybe have a group of people come to know Jesus, start raising up the leadership, and as he would move on, what would he say continually? Come on, you know this. We've reached the region. Well, we only went to one place. Just went to the city. So the idea that culture and thoughts and even religious beliefs and spiritual endeavors and the following of Christ filters out of the city itself as a center. So he would literally say, now he didn't go to every little neighborhood and village all around in those areas, but he would go to the main city centers and he would delve in there, and he was not in there very long, and he would be there maybe a year, a couple of years, maybe shorter than that, depending on how the leadership raised up. And then he would move on saying, we've reached that region. Let's move on. And he would go to another one. Sometimes I think a lot of guys I talk with, and a lot of guys, maybe I've talked with you about this at some point too, some of the guys I've talked to, kind of remove the idea of city, and we apply it to Paul in urban context, and we don't apply it to Christ. Because I think sometimes we have this kind of picture in our head that Christ was more walking around Galilee and kind of hanging out on the hillsides, and not so much city-focused. One of the things that kind of changed my opinion on that is the amount of times that the word city is used in the New Testament and where it's used. 26 times in Matthew, 39 times in Luke, and 27 times in Revelation. You know how many times it was used with Paul? 4. Okay? Now, it's a little skewed because Paul would name particular cities and not necessarily use the word all the time. But just to help you kind of put together the idea that Christ was and worked in urban centers. He didn't just walk around outside the cities. He did that also. But he also was very city-focused, and part of that was he would go into these different areas. He didn't stay there forever. He raised up indigenous leadership. That's what Paul carries on later. As minister of Christ, Paul continually says, I know nothing apart from the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's all I've got for you. I got one thing. But his model was hit an area, see people exposed to the gospel, see them come to Christ, and then he would leave, keeping in contact with them, but letting the indigenous, the local leadership lead, raise up and lead. Some of the areas where we see this, the city kind of thing go on, the angel Gabriel is sent to Nazareth, a city in Galilee in Luke. Zechariah is a city, is from a city on the hill country in Judah. Jesus heals a demonic man in a city in Galilee. Luke has this really interesting focus from Jesus' life about city centers and city focuses. Kind of has this whole thing. My goal is by the time you leave, you all move to the city. That's, I don't know if you're getting to that. Anyway, there's a city focus, and it's not just Paul and his church planning efforts in metropolitan areas. It's Christ also loved the city and led in the city. And part of it was raising up indigenous leadership. There's three kind of leaders, and Condon and Ortiz, if you guys haven't seen most of their stuff, kind of spend time on this. Relocated leaders. Relocated leaders are people that enter an urban community or any other community. Their book was centered on urban community, but you can relocate into the suburbs. Okay? So relocated leaders are people who enter the community from a distinctly different environment and culture, such as a rural or suburban context. Or just flip them. I'll flip those two terms. You can enter a suburban context as someone from the city and be relocated. Okay, so relocated leaders are people that enter from a different environment and culture. Indigenous leaders are those who grew up in the city and belong to a certain culture within that city. Okay, so one thing is, just because you're indigenous to the city doesn't mean you're indigenous to another neighborhood in the city. It doesn't mean you're indigenous to the whole city as general. Even in the suburbs, if you're indigenous to a suburban area, doesn't mean you're going to be indigenous to the neighboring suburban area. You're only indigenous to the certain culture that you've been in. And then multi-ethnic leaders are present where there's a multi-ethnic milieu, works alongside other types of leaders in a local church. This is usually found near city centers with universities, and schools kind of lend towards this because there's kind of a conglomeration and drawing of many different multi-ethnic kind of groups. So we're going to focus on indigenous leaders. What are the complications of developing indigenous leaders? What do you think?
It takes time.
It takes time. All right. What else? Is that the only complication? Are we that impatient?
It can feel imperialistic. I mean, it can feel like you unto them. You know, have a one-way learning.
Okay. It can feel somewhat imperialistic. What else? Okay. The culture, the local culture kind of dictates how you work through conflict. Yeah. Yep.
You're going to have to weed them out rather than your denomination. Weed them out ahead of time.
Rather than what?
Expound on that a little bit.
Rather than the denomination. Well, I mean, if you're pulling from the SBC and you're looking for somebody, you're screening already through a seminary. He's already screened people. You know what I mean? Or if you're just opening it up, I mean,
okay. So if your planting is relocated and you're gathering relocated leaders to go with you, mm-hmm. a lot of the screening process is done
right.
for you. Good point. We're going to hit on that, actually. What else?
It can, you can tend to lean towards being internal because, you know how things work, this is how it is, and just kind of the way it is. And you can tend to lean towards what you know, and everybody all has the same culture, instead of sometimes when you hear an outside perspective, you kind of go, look, they don't understand what we're talking about. We know, we get this.
Okay.
Steve Timmons in his book talked about pastors being middle-class, educated people, and they're going to look for calm, middle-class, educated people to disciple. And if you're in an area that doesn't have a high educational level, you're not going to find them.
Okay. Timmons' book,
Total Church.
If you're not familiar with that, it's a great book. Grab it, pick it up. It's put out by... It's not put out by Crossway. It's put out by Relit. Relit, yeah. So I used to check that one out, too. Any other complications you can think of to raising up indigenous leaders?
But there's a risk in terms of investing in someone significantly, and you don't know yet if he's going to actually turn down or she turn down as a leader.
Exactly. If you're relocated, how do you identify indigenous leaders? How do you even know who's going to be a leader? How do you do that? You're not part of the culture. What does that look like? I mean, it is risky. It's risky because of what we mentioned initially. It takes a pretty significant time investment to raise up indigenous leaders. So that's investment. It's time. It's resources. It's your ministry. You put a lot of work into that. How do you at least structure it well enough that there's a high, hopefully, potential for success in spiritual maturity there and leadership? So how do you find those guys? We're going to take a look at how to somewhat identify those things.
And the risk goes both ways, right? If you're an indigenous leader, you're placing yourself under the authority of a relocated leader, and you're going, is this guy really for real?
Does he even have a clue what's going on here? Yeah, absolutely.
Can't you be from one area, relocate, like Pastor Ethan, it's from D.C. I mean, we're now in North Philly, but it's still relative. I mean, like, rural recognizes rural. Like, I'm from Trenton, but it's similar to Northeast Philly.
Yeah. Urban, you're going to have carryover, right? If you're familiar with urban context, you'll have some urban carryover. But even the dynamics, okay, you're from Trenton, and do you live here in North Philly now?
No, I still come over from Trenton.
Okay, you come over from Trenton. Mm-hmm. There's still some cultural and sociological differences to being on the block, right? From here to being on the block in Trenton. One of the ones that we experience a lot is even, we're in Bridesburg, it's a totally different area of the city, but we're in the city. So we would be urban, and you guys would be urban, Pastor E's urban, when Pastor Mason and I and Jeff Bradford and Steve Huber all sit in a room together, guess how many things we have in common in what we're doing in our local churches? None. I mean, yeah, apart from Christ and the gospel, there's literally like almost nothing else, okay? It's like, so yeah, you can have urban mindset, but there's still the incarnational value that comes with being actually indigenous and growing up there. It's not to say that relocated doesn't work. Relocated works well in certain environments. Works great. I think we've seen that here with Eric and what's going on at Epiphany. We see that in a lot of different environments. But one of the things that even, you know, Eric and I talk about is he'll say, you know, the end goal is still to raise the church up from the people that live here. And that's where the legacy and the lifetime is left. If you plant relocated, I think scripturally you're still driven towards raising up indigenous leaders, even if you're a relocated leader yourself. And the risk, as Matt mentioned, goes both ways. If you're relocated, some indigenous people are going to maybe look at you with a trust issue, right? And there's going to have to be lots of walls broken down. Same way going the other way, as a relocated leader, you're going to have to figure out who you can trust and who to invest in. So there's a lot of time that goes into this. One of the key things that we're going to talk about today is this. If you are going into church planting, you're going to have to fight hard. Pastor Eric mentioned this downstairs. We're going to mention it here. Almost everybody, I think, is going to mention this today. You're going to have to fight hard against timelines.
Sure.
Okay? Whether real timelines or just in your head timelines. Mm-hmm. Okay? You're going to have to fight against them and make sure that you're patient and prayerful and you're allowing the Spirit to work and not just your organizational ability to work. Okay? Because God works differently, unfortunately, than we always figure out ahead of time, okay? Or fortunately, actually, okay? A lot of times, you always have this plan going in, right? We got a timeline. Sometimes the timeline matches up with what God does. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's accelerated. Sometimes it's stretched out. But one of the things I think that in a lot of ways the reasons denominations have not been able to reach a high level of indigenous leadership is because denominations are organizationally driven and they have hard and fast timelines. So this is one of the complications we've seen in church planting, trying to reach indigenous people, is you have a timeline. So there are financial constraints, there are time constraints, there are responsibility constraints, there are people you have to answer to, and you get to year two, and you're not where you said you were going to be at year two, because God's worked differently, and all of a sudden people start thinking that you're not doing anything, or that you're not going to make it, or that God's not at work, which you may just be at work differently than you thought. Okay, so I think sometimes one of the things that is hard that you're going to have to shape and what you're going to have to do if you haven't planted yet, or maybe if you're already under this, is I had some guys come alongside me when I was trying to figure out what church planting meant and what it looked like if God had called us to it. And one of the best advice I got was do not allow the people that want to give you money, okay, because right, what do all church planters need?
Money.
Right? Money and people. Okay? So don't allow the people that want to give you money to influence the timeline that God has already put in place or is going to continue to put in place. Don't say yes to things just to get a check. Okay? Because down the road, it's either going to be like a rock around your neck pulling you to the bottom of the ocean, or you're going to have to disappoint some people or not live up to commitments that you have made. Because maybe it wasn't a wise commitment. So just be real careful on the front end. As you're trying to raise money and recruit people and bring things in, be careful with timelines. Because I don't come from a heavily charismatic background, so I have to consciously leave room for the Spirit. All right? That's just something I've got to remind myself of. Okay? I am not the Holy Spirit. Okay? Sometimes I want to act like the Holy Spirit, but that is not the truth. And the Holy Spirit might work totally outside of bounds that I've already kind of thought are going to happen. And not only could he, but he does. I mean, I look back over the last 4 years of this journey through church planting, getting in almost 5 years now, getting into this, raising money, getting to launch, getting a couple years in. I'm like, you know what? I had this grandiose vision of what it was going to look like. And I look back and I'm like, that was, I don't even know what I was thinking. Maybe God allowed me to think that just so I would do it. But looking back on it, I'm like, those are a lot of them happen to be my ideas of how things should happen. When as you begin to engage indigenous leaders, you begin to realize the people that have only ever lived there, where you are going to if you're a relocated leader, the people that have only ever lived in that place, they know immensely more about the culture, the sociology that's there, the psychology of living there, everything. They know immensely more. You could spend 30 years. They'll still know more than you because they had a head start. Okay? So the key is being, one of the complications is this. One is time. We talked about money. We talked about a bunch of different stuff. Here's some of the complications I wrote down. Time, money, pride. Okay? Your pride is usually a pretty big barrier to raising up indigenous leadership, whether it means you're not the one that knows the most, or you're not the one that has the ability to train everybody else in every area. Maybe God gets to you in a certain area, but you need to be a learner and be humble and allow people that have grown up there and lived there their whole life to teach you. Doesn't mean you're not still the church planter. It doesn't mean you're still not the leader spiritually or in different ways. It just means that's what good leadership looks like, is you listen. You let them teach you. You let them change your mind on things that are negotiable, okay? And you shape it around what they're teaching you. So time, money, pride, and outside supporters. That's the other one I wrote. Outside supporters / timelines. Those are four major barriers to raising up indigenous leaders, okay? And if you're really committed to having a church that's about indigenous leaders and are seeing indigenous leaders raise up and lead, then you got to kind of probably confront those four things. Time, money, pride, both yours and the pride of those that you are coming in contact with, and also outside supporters and timelines. Okay, so make sure you're just kind of thinking through that. Now, there's more. I got to tell you, I'm talking from our experience. There's obviously more barriers that are out there than that. But these are just some big ones that we've kind of encountered. Indigenous leaders already exist in an urban context or in any context. Okay? First, we must commit to believe that the leaders are already in our communities. We have to fight the idea that there's no leaders in the place we're going to. There are leaders in the place anywhere. There's always leaders. Okay? Wherever you go, someone leads. Now, they can lead negatively. They can lead irresponsibly or whatever. But there's leaders in each context you're going into. So we have to commit to believe that the leaders are already there. As we look at the young people in our neighborhoods, we must not look down on their usefulness. As Paul tells Timothy, we must see them with kingdom eyes. We must see the people around as leaders, people who have insights and intuitions that are far more sensitive to the needs of the community than ours. And our perceptions of leadership must be different from the world's perceptions of leadership. It's a quote by a guy, Wayne Gordon. Okay? What you view as leadership, if you are coming from a relocated standpoint, may not be what leadership looks like where you're going. Okay? Now, there's biblical principles of leadership. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the contextual leadership. What does leadership look like in a certain context to the culture you're going to? It might not look like what you have a preconceived idea of. So you have to go in, again, it's just kind of driving this humility aspect through us. You got to go in with your eyes open and kind of say, what do the leaders look like in my community? You know, maybe you come from a community. I grew up in a community, a suburban neighborhood, outside of what I thought was a city, which really wasn't a city, Syracuse. It was just a university with some houses around it. But I thought that was city. I thought it was urban. I knew who leaders were around there. I had spent 18 years of my life growing up there. So I knew I could identify who leaders were, and I had this picture. So you go into a different context, and you're kind of automatically looking for that same kind of person, right? Or doing those same kinds of things, politically active or pastors or leaders in most contexts, but maybe not in an urban context where you're going to. They probably should be, but they might not be. What does it look like? When I got to the area in Bridesburg where we live, I pretty quickly found out who the leaders were just by observing people. Okay, the leaders were mostly the guys that deal drugs. Okay, Bridesburg has a nice little family atmosphere, kind of safe area, and there's not a lot of cops there. So it means there is a lot of drug transaction that happens there. Okay, people from Center City that don't want to go out to the suburbs to sell their drugs, and people from the suburbs that don't want to go all the way to Center City to buy their drugs, happen to just meet up at places where there's not a lot of police officers. Okay? Bridesburg happens to be it. I ran into a narcotics officer, I think the second year I lived in my neighborhood. He said, oh yeah, we've got people all over these streets. It's a major drug hub. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm like, are you nuts? I'm like, we're talking about the same neighborhood here? I mean, come on. He's like, no, it is prevalent. This is a major transaction spot. And you may not have a ton of users that live here, but this is a major transaction spot. And I began to see that with young people, with teenagers in my neighborhood, the people that were respected were the guys that dealt the drugs. Because they had money, they had time, right? It's not a super time-consuming job, okay? But you can make a living, you can have a whole bunch of free time, you can buy cool stuff, materialism drives it, and young people look up to it and respect it. So I'm like, wow, how skewed has this become? But those are leaders, okay? Other leaders in our community, there's a certain group of guys that are called the Bridesburg Fathers Club, okay? And they run all of the athletic organizations for kids in our neighborhood. Those were guys who were prominent leaders, average guys, union guys with kids, that most of them grew up in the neighborhood and played the sports growing up, and now we're heading this up. So you just start to identify leaders. Now, where I grew up, that's not what I looked at as a leader. I looked at, pastors, politicians, whatever, okay, police officers, all looked like leaders to me where I grew up. This was a learning process. It was totally different, teaching me what a leader looked like in the community I grew up in. So you got to kind of take away your perceptions and begin to look at what a leader looks like in your neighborhood and then what the gospel means. Try to define for me. Indigenous is the word we throw around. Try to define for me what an indigenous leader is. Bill can't answer. Throw some stuff out there. What is an indigenous leader? Define it. If we're going to talk about raising up, we got to know who they are, right? What does this look like? Who are they?
Kind of like what Pastor Mason was saying, like the DNA. They kind of have the DNA of the area that they're in.
Mm-hmm. They have the DNA because they've been there.
They function on the
yep. He's an interesting principal. Can you ever change your DNA?
No.
Nope. Sorry. Right? I wanted many times to change my DNA to urban DNA. Okay? Or, you know, DNA that doesn't have to go to the gym in order to not weigh 200 pounds. Okay? Or DNA just whatever. I want to change my DNA. You can't. Okay? And you can't change your DNA sociologically either. You are who you are. The gospel can reform it, okay? But you never change your DNA. You're not going to ever have grown up somewhere other than where you grew up, okay? Unless it just becomes a figment of your imagination and you're making stuff up, all right? But you only grew up in one place. So indigenous leaders only grew up in one place, there. What else?
Say maybe like a sense of family. Like, in a healthy case, you would love where you're from, but at the very least, you're attached to it.
Okay. You're connected to it, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
Okay?
Maybe it's dysfunctional. You know, some people want to get away from their families, but it's always there.
Right.
You
know? Anything else? We can keep moving because I'm running out of time. For someone to change. There's a definition that comes from this book, Harvey Kahn and Manny Ortiz. Throw this out there. Those who have been raised, this is an indigenous leader, those who have been raised, don't feel like you got to write this down if you're trying to write it down. I'll just give it to you later. Those who have been raised in a particular cultural and sociological milieu who consider this context their own. They own it. It is who they are. They are there. Psychologically and sociologically, indigenous leaders find the city home or find the suburbs home. Just insert whatever indigenous is to different places. They have no ties to other contexts and they draw them to return to it. Okay? If you are a relocated leader, there's always a back door, isn't there? Okay, I mean, be honest. I'm a relocated leader. There's always a back door, all right? There's always some mythical view of happiness that I grew up in that I just wasn't old enough to see all the crap yet, okay? That I can think about going back to. Okay, there's always some other backdoor thing. They have no ties to other contexts that might draw them to it, or that they have overcome to remain in this urban setting, right? As a relocated leader, you have to overcome things in order to stay wherever you've gone. You've got to put things aside. You've got to try to change your mindset. You've got to try to put things out of your head. But an indigenous leader doesn't have that struggle. This is most commonly found in children, right? My kids will be indigenous to Bridesburg. They were born there. Well, they're actually born in Abington, but when they were typically 3 days old, they've only lived in one place, okay? They've lived in Bridesburg. Okay, that's where they grew up. They find all their resources for life in the community. My kids, as far as they know, they don't need to leave our neighborhood for anything. Okay? That's their worldview. They can stay right there. They got everything they need. The music, culture, and language of the city have become their own. They find meaning and interpret the world through the eyes of their community experience. Okay? Everything gets interpreted by where you came from.
Amen.
It's just the way it goes. That's your filter. Okay? Everything you look at is filtered by what you know. So it's just that different. So the difference between relocated and indigenous is really just initial worldview. And if you're a relocated leader, one of the things you'll have to fight is, if this church planting thing doesn't work out for you, what are you going to do? You're going to leave? If you're an indigenous leader and the church planting thing doesn't work out, you're not going anywhere anyway. Right? I mean, you're just here. This is home. So the church planting works out, church planting doesn't work out. I'm still going to live here. Right? So there's a whole different level of just innate natural commitment that happens with an indigenous leader. The raising up of indigenous leaders is often ignored by church planters and denoms, but it is extremely vital to the long-term impact of a church in a city. Okay? We talked a little bit about that. There are some reasons why we've gone away from raising up indigenous leadership and the time and investment that it takes to do that, and it's because we are a think quick, happen quick, quick results, instant gratification culture.
Sure.
Okay? I can get on my computer right now, as a matter of fact, and probably find out almost any information I want. Okay? Google it, Wikipedia, whatever. I'll just find it. Okay? We are just, it's part of who we are to want things to happen quickly. And typically, I'm not going to say 100% of the time, because I have seen instances where it doesn't. Indigenous leaders raise up quickly some places. But typically, Raising up indigenous leadership means you're going to have to be there longer before you see the results you're looking for.
Yeah.
You're going to have to invest more than it would take to relocate a bunch of people with you because you can see some instant work with them right away. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's a whole different kind of viewpoint. And in a lot of ways, we've worked away from indigenous leadership because over the last, I mean, I don't know how long, Bill could probably speak to this, you know, better than I could, but when you look at church planting over the last maybe 15 years, it's just, it is structured so quickly because of timeline that you have to relocate people. You've got to transition people and bring them with you. Otherwise, you can't meet the expectations that are placed. So you've got to kind of reshape the expectations. These are some of the benefits to indigenous leaders and what they do for you in church planting or in any ministry. They eventually become the contextualists walking the community filled with the Holy Spirit. Okay? They're just walking around. They're living life the way they've always lived in life. Now they've just got the Holy Spirit. They've got the gospel, and they're just doing their thing with the people that they've always done it with, the way that they've always known how to do it, but now it's just been infused with the gospel. They're able to contextualize the gospel, bring a Messiah to the neighborhood that speaks their language and understands their needs. Okay? I don't say use guys, all right? I've actually tried to use it, but it just doesn't work for me, all right? So in Bridesburg, as soon as somebody hears you not say that word, they know you're not from there. Okay? I mean, here's a use guys. What? Plural? Are you talking plural? What's going on? It's like, but that's just natural. If you grew up there, you just talk that way. Okay? It's just who you are. It's the way you've learned. So they can contextualize in a way that you probably won't ever be able to do or understand the needs that you probably won't ever be able to fully see. They see the city or the suburbs or wherever as their home and their mission. Their commitment to the city and its healing is long-term and natural. Okay? You don't have to ingrain in them a DNA that wants to see gospel transition or transformation in the place where they are. They are already invested. It's already natural. They want to see that there. They're bought in. They own it. There's no need to convince them about their city or their suburb or wherever. In their mind, there's only urban pictures. This is a great thing that I got out of Ray Bakke's book I was reading about. When they think, we all think in pictures, right? So when somebody who is indigenous to a place, when they think, the pictures all look like there, right? They look like there. So when they think about what a church is going to look like, they already know what it should look like for their context. You know, we go into church planners, we're like, okay, we're going to spend like 6 months figuring out what a church looks like. And you have to do your homework. You've got to do that. You've got to put in the time. One of the things you need to do is just listen to the people that live there. What does a church look like in your eyes? Yeah? What does it look like? What's it going to be shaped like? Yeah? What does community look like? What does worship look like here? What does, you know, neighborhood transformation look like here? And as you learn, they just think these things, these are natural things for them. They're accustomed to the noise, busyness, and crowdedness. This is urban focus. And they don't compare it to another way of life. I cannot tell you how many times I've had conversations with transplanted leaders that have said, just naturally, they haven't meant anything by it. They haven't meant it derogatorily or any other way, but they say, I should remember how quiet the suburbs were. I'm like, yeah. I mean, what do you say? But apart from the fact that if you're indigenous, there is no other thing, right? There's no other thing. It's just, that's what it is. You're accustomed to it. You don't even hear it, really. I mean, I now, like, my parents come and visit. Like, I just even hear the cars going by all night. I'm like, cars? There's cars? We sleep with the windows open. I don't hear. We live on a pretty busy street. Trucks going by all night, back and forth. I don't even hear them anymore. Doesn't mean anything. We live two blocks from the fire station. Fire truck can literally go by, and I don't even hear it. It doesn't even, sirens are going on. It doesn't register. Okay? Think about if you had grown up there and this is all you've ever known, this stuff's all just very natural. They understand the temporality of possessions and property, right? If you grew up in the city, something gets stolen, it actually is not a big deal, is it? Because you were probably expecting it to get stolen at some point anyway, right? It just happened now, okay? I remember the first thing I got stolen after I moved into the city. There's just part of me that's like, I have been violated. somebody took something that was mine, okay? But about a year ago, my wife's bike got stolen off our back porch, okay, and some tools that I had sitting out there. And I remember, like, somebody coming by, and like, can I borrow this tool? I'm like, oh, no, I got stolen off our back porch. And like, it got stolen. I'm like, no, nope, yeah. I mean, like, at some point you start to think that way, that there's a temporality to possessions and things because that's part of being urban. Now, if you're in the suburbs, it's very different, right? This is a great analogy that Manny Ortiz uses in his book. In the suburbs, just to help you think through philosophically, in the suburbs, you hear a siren. What does it mean? You hear a police siren coming? Safety, rescue, protection, right? In the city, those of you that are from the city, maybe raise your hand. What does a police siren mean? Trouble, right? You don't want to be near it because something might go down, okay? So it's just that one thing, the same thing in both environments, totally different worldviews, okay? So just starts kind of getting you thinking through some of this stuff. How do we use indigenous leaders? We need to be utilizing indigenous leaders, and it's the most effective way to reach communities for Christ. It's imperative that anyone chosen to lead must first be brought to spiritual maturity. That's one of the major challenges with raising up indigenous leaders, is they probably do not already have a biblical worldview and filter. So you need to go slow, not lay your hands on quickly, but let them mature before you turn leadership over to them,
sure.
Right? The opposite of just wanting to relocate people and grow a church fast is the idea that we just want to be known for raising up indigenous leaders. So as soon as somebody from the hood gets saved, we just hand over leadership to them, right? Which is just really poor stewardship, okay? And not what the Bible says to do. So you have to be able to be invested long enough to let spiritual maturity take place. Okay, we talked about most of this time. It's a task that takes a tremendous amount of time and effort by existing leader and by the potential leaders on both sides. There's a huge investment in this. The mentoring model of training seems best suited for this task and is more intensive and demanding than other approaches to training, which means the time invested by a mentor, trainer, leader needs to count, and the selection of a potential leader becomes all the much more important, right? If you're investing a ton of time, you've got to be somewhat selective about who you're doing that in because you only have so much time. You can't create more. How to identify potential indigenous leaders? They must first be what? Before they serve the church, before we start giving them responsibility, they have to be servants of Christ. Okay, so in 1 Corinthians 4:1, it talks a little bit that first they must serve Christ before we ever get them trying to engage serving in the church, because they need to understand what it means to follow Christ and serve him. Does this mean you can't plug people in to doing different acts of service? No, you can do that. But leadership has to be something that has been laid, the foundation has been laid by serving Christ in their life, internalizing the gospel, change. You see the DNA, Eric was talking about downstairs. You see people living, not just talking. Okay, it's pretty easy to just pick up the right lingo. Right? You can change language and know the right stuff to say. But in order to actually be qualified to lead, you have to be serving Christ in your life and the things that you're doing. Need to make decisions based upon an understanding of the prospective leader's present characteristics and an anticipation of what the leaders will be under the influence of the Word and the Holy Spirit in the future. So to identify someone who can be an indigenous leader, you have to see character traits that they have, and as a maybe a relocator or maybe you're indigenous, but as you're looking to raise up indigenous leaders, you have to actually have a vision for what that person's potential looks like, what their leadership gospel impact looks like with the Holy Spirit and spiritual maturity plugged into it. And then you have to help them walk towards that. Okay, one of the best definitions, a guy named Bob Logan does this stuff called CoachNet. It's just basically coaching in general. It's a lot of times applied to church planting, but in general they do coaching. Coaching is simply helping people realize what God's doing in their life and helping them get there. Okay? There's a difference between that and instructing, right? This is a great misnomer for me. I coached college basketball for a number of years, and coaching in that context is not really coaching. It's instructing. I am telling guys what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. So just go do it. That's the main role there, right? This is our offense. This is how it's set up. This is our defense. This is how it's set up. This is what you do in this scenario. This is what you do in this scenario. Go work the plan out. You're instructing. Coaching is coming alongside, okay, in life coaching and ministry coaching or church planning coaching. Coaching is coming alongside with indigenous leaders and saying, what's God doing in your life? What are the characteristics, the traits he's already given you that can be redeemed by the gospel and used for his good? And how are we going to move you through to spiritual maturity and doing that? Some of it might take 6 months. Some of it might take 6 years. Okay? But the idea of raising up indigenous leaders is the best foundation we have to lay for churches.
Here's,
what's that? Yeah, I didn't hear it. There's a noise. Okay, here's some character qualities to look for. A couple of these books agree on these. These are some of the ones I mentioned. They have to be a servant. They have to be a steward. They have to be a student. And they have to have a specific call to leadership. This is an urban community, but in their community. Okay, whatever it is. These are four things that we use in real life, that I use in real life, to identify who the leaders are and who they can be. They have to be a servant of Christ and of the church and of others. They have to be a steward. They've got to know how to steward stuff. Know how to use things that aren't theirs, right? Everything we have has been given to us by God. They have to be good stewards of stuff. If they don't know how, you might have to teach them how and show them how, but you have to see that before you hand leadership over to them. That's one of the biggest downfalls. One of the reasons the church, I think, moved a lot away from a lot of stuff I've read about church history. I haven't been around forever. But a lot of stuff I read about church and church planting has been one of the reasons denominations themselves moved away from indigenous planting is they got burned. They laid hands on too quickly. They turned responsibility over to non-spiritually mature indigenous leaders because they just wanted to see indigenous leadership. But you can't just want to see that. You have to want to see spiritually mature indigenous leadership that can handle the things that you're turning over to them and leading the church. They have to be a student. They always have to be learning. We talked about pride on the relocated leader's heart and mind and things like that, coming into a scenario thinking they know more than they do. You have to be careful with anyone with pride. But the specific thing with an indigenous leader is, sometimes what happens with indigenous leaders, they raise up and they know more about the culture than you. And instead of seeing that as a gift and as something to use for the gospel, sometimes what happens is they stop being a student and they think they know everything already. Okay, so you want to make sure that you're looking for character qualities and then a specific call to leadership in the urban community. If somebody doesn't have a call on their life, don't try to give them one. Okay? Not your job, not my job. Now, I want to sometimes, and I will confess sometimes I do. Okay? And then I look back and I'm like, shoot, that was my call, and I gave it to them because I wanted to see them do it. And I didn't let God put a call in their life and then identify it with them and help them get there. I was forced to, you know, square peg, round hole kind of thing. But I've got a big hammer, and if I hit it hard enough, they'll get in there. Okay? So, you know, but there's going to be a shrapnel in the midst of it, all right? Stuff breaks. So you want to make sure you're kind of, this is not a total list, but these are the ones for us and for other guys I've talked with that have been very helpful. You're looking for servant, steward, student, and a specific call in their life. So this is what they should be doing. And then as you work through it, hopefully what happens is you have indigenous leaders raising up, and 10, 20 years from now, you're not doing the same work you're doing now because the people that are already from there, you've seen them go from spiritual unseen to spiritual maturity, and they're there. So probably some of the stuff I got to talk with you about today may be new to you. Some of it may not be. Maybe you've read some of these books. Maybe you've talked to some of these people. But I would greatly encourage you to pick some of these up as resources. Whether you're in the city or not in the city, no matter where you are, as a leader, the clearest, it's pretty clear for me, and some people disagree with that, it's pretty clear for me from Scripture that indigenous leadership is what God's shooting for in the church. It's what we see all through the New Testament, first century church. You form community around people that are being engaged with the gospel and coming to know Christ, and they need a church. You look through the New Testament, Paul didn't go into a place saying, hey, let's start a church, and maybe people will get saved. No. He went in places, shared the gospel as much as he could. People got saved, and then he was just drawing the people together that had come to Christ. and helping them formalize the church a little bit. Writing back to him, you need to step out, you need to do this, here, this is a good idea, do this, okay? But he didn't walk in and say, we're planting a church right over here, and after we plant the church, hopefully we'll get some people that live here to come to know Christ. So the key, the initial key to anything, really, in any kind of ministry is share the gospel, watch for God's grace in people's lives. As you see fruit from the gospel, then you start putting some of these things in place. And you start trying to identify leaders, servant, steward, right, specific call, a student, all these kinds of things. You're trying to identify those after you've seen the grace of God move in their life and transform them. Once you see it, then you say, okay, now we need to kind of identify this stuff. Okay. I just want to open it up for a few minutes. I think we have a few minutes. No, we don't. I'm lying. We don't have a few minutes. But I'll take any questions. We have a couple minutes because Phil's the exec guy, and he hasn't even let his group out yet, so I'm going by him. He's a better time manager than I am. So. Questions?
Can you talk about how you ratcheted up or down your expectations of leadership? Because it sounds like you're in a working-class community, so you guys are union workers, you know, I'm sure. Other guys are over in executive communities, so those guys run on Microsoft Outlook. It doesn't sound like your guys do that. It sounds like they come home, have a beer, and like football.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Sure.
Because most ministers are graduate level.
Yeah. I mean, we've had to re-identify what we thought leadership looked like.
Okay.
Probably, I would say, about 3 or 4 different times now. And I think we're probably getting closer to what we think it needs to look like. I don't think we've figured it out totally. What I do think is some of the transitions we had to go through was, I went to Bible college, I grew up in a Christian environment in a big church. I had a view of what I thought that looked like. And I don't think initially it was very biblical. It was mostly, I don't know, just my worldview placed upon it. So yeah, we had to start realizing, hey, in a blue-collar, middle-class, union worker neighborhood, right, it's just going to look different. It's going to look like, wow, this guy's a leader because he got saved, the gospel transformed his life, and now he goes back to, he's on mission. He's back to the same places he used to hang out at, right, plays pool, has a beer, and watches the Eagles and tells people about Jesus while he's doing it. So for me, that's how leadership is identified for us, is watching guys live out the gospel on mission in their context. And it's going to look different 10 blocks away from me than it does where I am. There's going to be spiritual qualities that will be the same. Your First Timothy, Titus passages talk about elders in the church. I mean, guys attaining towards leadership, attaining towards eldership, they need to have those things in place. But how it gets fleshed out day to day in context is going to be different. It's going to look, you know, some people come to us, I get the funniest question I ever get is, hey, we're looking to start a coffee shop. How should we do it? I don't know. You guys did it? Yeah, but it was a mess, let me tell you. People are like, wow, you guys owned a building before you launched. And I'm like, yes, do not do that ever, please, right? You're just like, we have this view sometimes when we see things working, we just want to make them work again somewhere else. And don't do that. You got to get in, dig in, and see what God's doing, see what's going to work there. So it works with leadership and every other way that you kind of shape the biblical principles. So how have we changed it? We've changed it a couple of times because we saw it coming, and we've changed it a couple of times because we've been hit in the face with it. So, hopefully we get less of getting hit in the face. Not real big on that. So hopefully we see it coming more often because we're being humble and teachable and being students while we go through. That kind of give you?
Yeah.
I mean, there's practical stuff, but honestly, even if I told it to you, it probably wouldn't apply to anything. So it's just stuff we've seen with guys in our neighborhood. But there are very distinct. I would have no clue how to identify leaders in the financial district downtown. It would take me a while to learn how to do that. I think we've learned some principles of doing it where we live. There's still more we're going to learn, but we've learned some about it. Cool. So, any other kind of questions, comments? Stuff I didn't cover that you were looking for? Ask questions. You know, what were you looking for coming in that we didn't, that I didn't hit on? Anything else? Nothing? Yeah.
It kind of, where we're at in Central Jersey, it's kind of a conglomerate of different areas of town. They're all kind of unified because of their geographical location.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like you said, 10 blocks down the road, different indigenous people look different. So is it possible to raise indigenous leadership with those different communities, even ethnically? Because, like, we pull from, just because of geographically, our community, church communities, everything, these guys from these different communities come mm-hmm. together. So you, I guess, can you speak to that?
Yeah. There are some guys in the room right now, actually, that are more well-versed in the regional kind of church model than I would. Matt being one, he's in the church of Board Draws regionally. Bill taught me a lot of principles about this kind of idea, identifying what God's called you to be as a church planner and as a church, the vision he's given. Is it going to be neighborhood-oriented? Is it going to be regionally oriented? What is it going to look like? There's no right and wrong in there. It's just figuring out the call. And then once you figure out the call, you do it. So regionally, it's probably going to look like you've got indigenous leaders that are going to be different from each other in different areas that they come from. So they, you know, Matt might speak into that a little bit, and he's one of the guys I know.
But then all of their people. So you send your leaders back to their people.
Yeah.
And I think there's a Jesus model for doing that. With the demoniac, the Gerasenes, the idea is you go back to your people. So if you're a student and you come to church at our church, we want you to go back to your people on campus. Not everybody at our church is a student. If you're a business person in our church, we want you to go back to the people that you do business with.
Right. That's just the concept of being missional. Don't try to... I think initially we all kind of go in with a mindset of maybe what we think they should become to look like once they get the gospel and get changed. But make sure we're sending them back. That's a big thing. Thanks for plugging that in, Matt. That's one of the biggest things.
I think the question is, what's your neighborhood, right? I mean, if it's an urban plan,
right?
You're ministering to your neighborhood. If it's a regional plan, you're sending people back to their neighborhood.
Right.
So they may come to your church.
Right. And we've gone through kind of an interesting transition just recently. We moved where we're meeting. We're not meeting in the center of our neighborhood anymore, in our coffee shop. We're meeting on the edge of our neighborhood in a school. The school itself draws regionally, so we're starting to engage more of that from people in other communities, Mayfair, Wissanomic, kind of spreading out a little bit. You have people coming from New Jersey, just different things. So we're starting to see more of that, and honestly, it's made us have to rethink some of the things we're doing with people because it's kind of multifaceted now, so we've had to kind of look at it differently. So for me, I'm probably at a stage in my ministry life where I'm more comfortable with the people right in my neighborhood and figuring out how to get them to, I haven't figured out the other stuff yet, but getting them to get back into their homes and their blocks, because even in a neighborhood, you still have pockets, you know? People, you send them back to their block. It just might be a smaller pocket than a different region of the area, but you're sending them back to their block to reach the people that they have block parties with, have birthdays with, people that go in their backyard to use their pool. You're sending them back to that little area, and they've got to be missional there and engage those people. So I think the concept's pretty much transferable. People come to the gospel, you send them back to where they came from. Sometimes the church kind of wants to absorb them and pull them into the church culture. We want to get the gospel sent back into the culture they came from to engage it. Yeah.
In your specific context, what has been the top one or two most effective ways of turning converts?
Walking my dog. Honestly. You always ask yourself, what's your best evangelical connection? I walk my dog. Because people will stop. I have a pretty cute dog. People stop and talk to me because I have my dog. Now, if I'm walking by myself, I'm 6'4", kind of a bigger guy, walking down the street in the city. I just have a particular pace that I walk a little quicker than some people. Not a lot of people walk up and talk to me. Just, you know, I have a motorcycle. I ride my motorcycle. Not a lot of people stop and talk to you. It's just not the way it goes. So, for me, in our neighborhood, two of the biggest things, walking my dog, and then we started having kids who push a stroller, you're golden. Everybody will stop and talk to you, okay? Oh, you're so cute. Yes. Okay, so then Val and I actually set up in our neighborhood, we would choose blocks and say, okay, for the next 2 weeks, we probably take a walk for a half hour to an hour, three or four times a week in our neighborhood. So we would choose a block. So for the next 2 weeks, we're just walking this same route. So we run into the same people. So, and then I push the stroller, she walks the dog, and we get everybody. Okay, so some people like dogs, some people like kids. You get to talk to them. Okay, so for us, that's been just a very natural piece for us. Best way for us to meet people and new people to share the gospel with has been walking in our community, eating in our community, shopping in our community, all that kind of stuff.
And do you invite them to your house? Do you invite them to your church? Do you just contact evangelism right there on the street after you meet them three or four times?
I think it depends. It depends. Sometimes I do engage them right there. Sometimes I just find out what they're involved in. You know, now my kids are old enough. My son plays T-ball, and I coach local in the rec league. I coach basketball. So, like, your kids play this, they play, you find out where they are, and then you just figure out where you're going to connect with them, and you go that way. But sometimes, yeah, if it's natural and it's right there, go for it. We got to wrap up. Any other closing thoughts? Thanks for coming up, guys. We've got, if you want any of these notes or anything, I'll just email them to you. So if you walk up and write your email address on a piece of paper, I'll just shoot them to you, and you can have them. So thanks for coming up. Hopefully we'd like to see you guys again and hear what's going on. So we'll go back downstairs. They are going to get rolling here pretty quick with Jeff's session. So try to make your way back down.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Great job.
Thanks for coming.
Brooklyn, New York. I know you're following. Danny Burns.
Are you Edwin?
Yeah.
Oh, Edwin! I've heard so much about you, and I have not met you, so I just couldn't meet you, Dad. Thanks for coming. Yeah, you probably didn't meet
him. No, okay. You did a great job.
You guys have done this a lot longer than I have.
Really good job.
Okay. Cool. Awesome. I appreciate that. Hey, now, where are the guys you brought with you?
Mickey.
Mickey? Yeah, nice to meet you, Mickey. I'm so glad you guys came down.
Yeah,
sent him in the other spot?
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah,
cool. Are you sticking around for dinner? Or are you guys going to take right off?
Well, after the last session, we're going to go ahead and take off because we've got a business meeting at church.
Okay.
Stuff going on.
I want to talk to you guys some more about what's
that.
Going on.
I'd love that. Really connect with you and pick your brain. I can get your email.
Yep.
Yeah. Card.
Yep, I can give you mine.
Thank you.
If you give me yours, I'll probably just leave it.
Okay.
That's pretty much what I do.
Okay.
Should we meet again?
Excellent. Take care.
It's great to meet you.
Good to meet you.
Ray's not with you, right?
No,
he has something going on.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, keep it in mind if you really just don't want it.
You kept it just fine.
Yeah.